Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas on June 23rd in Tampa. Sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Hurricane preparation means more than stockpiling a couple bottles of water and a radio. It also means preparations for your home.
You know the fasteners. Are they still handy? Who's it going to take to help you put up your shutters? How soon in advance must you start?
Also this week, Florida officials want the public to be aware about increased wildfire danger.
We just want people to be careful and be wary that it is a possibility for wildfires to happen. So pay attention to what you're doing and be safe.
We'll also get a late-breaking story out of the state Supreme Court about an important judicial job in South Florida and get up close and personal with one of the more controversial Florida candidates for the U.S. Senate. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Well, you probably heard this one before. Hurricane season is here, and it's time to get ready. But Florida Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater says there's more to hurricane prep than one might think. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Hurricane preparedness is about more than bottled water and batteries. That's according to Florida CFO Jeff Atwater.
Your children, seniors possibly traveling with you, will still need their medications. Do you have all their health care information? You're going to need access to your finances. Do you have all your bank records and finances with you?
And then there's your home. Atwater recommends homeowners check with their insurance agents to make sure they're covered and that any new renovations or additions are noted. And he says Floridians should consider their home's structural security.
Our neighbors have moved those shutters around in their garage time after time. Do you know the fasteners? Are they still handy? Who's it going to take to help you put up your shutters? How soon in advance must you start? All of this because you're going to be running to protect your most precious, certainly your most significant asset, which would be your property.
So Atwater says he thought an example could help. He teamed up with the International Hurricane Research Center at Florida International University, where Arindam Chaudhary, the director of the Wind Engineering Research Lab, walked insurance officials and members of the media through an experiment using the so-called wall of wind.
So what we are going to see today is the power of the wall of wind. We have a structure here, which is constructed as a pre-Andrew kind of structure. So it has the toenails and things like that, which were used before. Now,
toenailing involves driving a nail at an angle while attaching two perpendicular pieces of wood. New techniques require the use of hurricane straps. But Chaudhary says more than 80% of the buildings in Florida are constructed using the older methods. And he says that can lead to devastating damage during a hurricane. Chaudhary starts the wind, then comes the rain.
So now we see the wind-driven rain starts. You can see pretty much how the wind separates from the sharp edges of the building. So under those kind of separations, you create a very high wind suction on the structure. We reached a Category 1 because we exceeded the 74 miles per hour. So this is like a Category 1 wind speed.
The wind speed continues to increase. Participants are watching the experiment on a screen, but if you listen closely, you can hear a low hum. That's the wind. The speed reaches 110, about a Category 2 or 3 hurricane, and then the structure loses its roof. Chaudhary says the wind combined with the rain, which would now be going inside, ruining a family's belongings, adds up to significant damage. But that's not all.
Imagine that these kind of elements failing from the building can become windborne debris.
Right.
So it's not only damage to your own building, but it's going to go and hit the downwind building. And again, one of the biggest losses beside the wind and the rain are damages from windborne debris, which we have seen in Hurricane Wilma.
Chaudhary and Atwater urge homeowners to consider how their homes are constructed and to consider retrofitting them to ensure their homes and the homes of their neighbors are safe this hurricane season. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Well, as we just heard, hurricane season may have just started, but Florida officials are also warning the state's residents about the increased risk of wildfire danger around this time of year. And we got that story from Sasha Cordner.
We're going to break into two groups. We're going to have an ignition crew, which will be Caroline and Kevin. We're going to have a holding crew, Jerome, Ron, and Jason. So let's get our tools and get our stuff, and let's head out to the unit.
That's Eric Stoller, the land manager at Tall Timbers Research Station in Tallahassee. He leads a team that does do prescribed burns and studies its impact on the ecosystem. Prescribed burns are control burns that have a positive impact on vegetation. It can help reduce the risk of wildfires, which is the on-plan fire that can damage huge forest areas.
What we like about prescribed fires, it reduces wildfire risk. We are getting to wildfire season. And places that have wildfires are places that prescribed fire is not being maintained on a frequent level.
Places like swampy areas and near very populated areas have less frequent prescribed burning, for instance. Florida wildfires, meanwhile, can occur year-round, but during this time of year, there is an increased risk as it gets into the drier months.
So we are in a drier pattern than we have been over a lot of part of the state. And it may just be in secluded areas, but we still have a possibility for wildfires in some of these areas.
That's Rhonda Sutphin, the Wildfire Prevention and Mitigation Coordinator for the Florida Forest Service. She says Floridians should also watch out for increased lightning activity. Thunderstorms and excessive lightning have already sparked wildfires in several coastal areas of the state, and lightning accounts for about a fourth of Florida's annual wildfire activity.
Well, this time of year, we start to see more of the high-pressure systems where we have the afternoon showers. A lot of times it's along the edge of the sea breeze, and those showers are more of a pop-up type of a shower to where they have more lightning and less rainfall, so there's more chance of wildfires to start this time of year from lightning strikes.
Hurricane season just started, and Sutphin says the storms usually bring rain, which can help wildland firefighters. But she adds, just like with a hurricane, Floridians should always have a plan in case of wildfire danger.
Along the lines of the hurricanes is the be prepared. So you want to have a kit ready to go and an action plan for your family and your pets if you need to evacuate, whether it's from a wildfire or a hurricane. So you need the same type of supplies as you would in a hurricane kit. So we encourage people to go ahead and get both of those kits ready and be prepared for either one that may happen.
And she adds they are asking the public to exercise caution with all outdoor fires due to the increased risk.
We'd like people just to be careful with what they do. If they're recreating outside and they're cooking, barbecuing, be careful with your coals where you get rid of those. And if you're burning yard debris, cleaning up your yard, never leave a fire unattended. Be cognizant of the weather and the weather conditions. If it's dry and if it's windy, don't burn.
Sutphin adds if anyone sees a fire or even a potential wildfire, report it to your nearest Florida Forest Service office or call 911. There are about 57 active wildfires currently burning throughout Florida. Since January, the Florida Forest Service has already responded to 1,200. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll have a one-on-one conversation with an outspoken Florida contender for the U.S. Senate.
Until that process is foolproof, then part of people from that part of the world shouldn't be allowed into this country. It's not very complicated for me.
What's constitutional and what's not when it comes to drunk driving evidence remains a hot topic in the courts.
The more that you allow those warrantless searches and seizures to chip away at our constitutional rights, the less and less rights we have.
And soon-to-be unemployed circus elephants may have a new job helping people conquer cancer. Bradenton home builder Carlos Baruff is a leading Republican contender to succeed U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, also the son of Cuban immigrants. Baruff has never held elected office, but is a well-known campaign contributor. He's also served on the Southwest Florida Water Management District, the State College Board, Governor Rick Scott's Health Care Commission, and a regional airport authority. He recently spoke with Florida Public Radio's Jim Ash.
Well, let me ask you a couple of the points you were making in your plan here. A lifetime ban on lobbying.
That's part of the problem in Washington. These guys go up there, they put in 8, 10, 12 years, and they leave Washington, and now they're making $500 to $1 million in lobbying fees that, quite frankly, isn't the way we were supposed to have this country run.
You also propose an across-the-board 20% reduction in the federal workforce.
In the civilian workforce, yeah.
That would be huge.
Not really. It's not really that huge. That's the problem with bureaucracies this large. Not the problem. It's that one of the benefits is that you have a natural attrition rate of anywhere from 2 to 4% a year. So really, you don't have to fire anybody. You just have to stop hiring people.
Yeah. Can you sell yourself as an outsider, considering you have served on these appointed boards?
That's what gives me the experience to hold these bureaucracies accountable and make them efficient. I was an outsider till I was 50 years old. I'm still an outsider. I spent my whole life in the private sector, and then I've taken that experience into these bureaucracies and made them leaner and respectful to the taxpayers' dollars because they had no respect for them in many cases.
You're selling your candidacy largely on your business experience, but there are a lot of people who say government is not a business, has to take care of people who can't take care of themselves.
That's still a business. You're still delivering services to the taxpayer. It's still a business. It's not like you tell people you're going to run government like a business. It is a business.
Your business background draws the inevitable comparison to Donald Trump. Do you like being compared to Trump? Do you support him?
I do support him. I don't know. The comparisons are only, look, I'm a flea on an elephant compared to Donald Trump. We're in a building industry, though he builds 90-story buildings, and I build maybe one-story houses.
You called for a temporary ban on immigration from the Middle East, with the exception of Israel. Wouldn't that deny us the benefits of people like the Baruff family?
Well, no. Here's where we get off the tracks here when we start talking about this subject. Not only the FBI director, but the CIA director, both publicly have said that they simply do not have the necessary data to properly vet people from that part of the world that are a danger to American citizens. Until that process is foolproof, then people from that part of the world shouldn't be allowed into this country. It's not very complicated for me. Now, when you start saying, yes, we immigrated I was born in the United States, but my parents came from Cuba. We went through the paperwork, and it was a different era.
You released an internal poll earlier this week that showed it's pretty much a dead heat in the Republican field. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think it's a dead heat. We're leading, and there's a dead heat between two people, but the rest of the pack is way down on the totem pole. So I think I think the people are fed up with people who all they do is talk for a living and have never accomplished anything in their life. But I could be wrong. I guess we'll find out in 87 days or 88 days.
Do you worry about Marco Rubio getting into the race?
No, I stopped worrying the day I made the decision to do this. At the end of the day, I'm going to work as hard as I can, put the financial resources in necessary to communicate our message, and if the people of Florida vote for somebody else, obviously that's what they do. But I think people are fed up with the status quo and career politicians.
You know, you have a history of contributing heavily to them. The folks at the Tampa Bay Times have calculated $1 million you've donated since 2001. Does that mean you're a player and you've been part of the system?
I guess Donald Trump is an insider too then. Because I guarantee you, he spent more than $1 million in the last 15 years.
And you've been very generous with your time.
Thank you. Take care.
The Honorable Laura Johnson is getting a promotion, moving up to the Circuit Court in Palm Beach County. But Nick Evans reports that leaves an opening on the county court bench. And the question of who gets to fill that seat has been decided by the Florida Supreme Court. Nick gives us the background on that decision.
The qualifying period to run for judicial posts was open from noon May 2nd until the 6th. At the close of that period in Palm Beach County, Judge Laura Johnson was the only circuit court candidate. So she'll take up that post next year without appearing on the ballot. But before she could put her name in the hat, she had to abandon her existing seat.
It's called Resign to Run, and that law has been enacted since about 1970.
This is Susan Booker, Palm Beach County's Supervisor of Elections.
And so Judge Johnson was a county judge in Group 11 seat in Palm Beach County, and she desired to run for circuit court, the next higher court. And so she brought in a letter of resignation within the statutory deadline, which is 10 days before the qualifying.
University of Florida law professor Timothy McClendon explains Johnson had to give up the seat because of Florida's resign to run law.
And so to commit to run to a different office, you must resign the office you currently hold. That's the principle behind it.
The governor and secretary of state argue Johnson's resignation triggers the governor's appointment powers. They say her announcement creates a vacancy because it came before the qualifying period to fill her seat through an election.
But that defies, quite honestly, logic and common sense to limit it to that time.
That's Palm Beach County attorney and judicial hopeful Greg Lerman. Booker explains Lerman and fellow attorney Thomas Baker filed paperwork to run for Johnson's empty seat shortly after her resignation.
So based upon all of the legal background, we did accept two candidates' qualifying papers, and they have since filed a lawsuit with the Florida Supreme Court that's being considered right now.
And this isn't the first time Resign to Run has prompted tricky questions. In the past 40 years, state officials have turned to Florida's Division of Elections well over 100 times for advisory opinions about the law's application. And Lerman argues the courts have already held resignations coming once the electoral process begins should be filled by election. So the question here is, when does that process begin? Is it the start of qualifying, as the governor argues, or, in the case of a Resign to Run vacancy, does it begin with the advance notice? Here's attorney Greg Lerman again.
You have to resign 10 days before, not less, but 10 days or more before the qualifying period in order to run. So the electoral process really begins for a particular seat when that individual, be it again a judge or a deputy or some other elected office, when that individual resigns from that office for that particular seat.
I think it is a difficult question. I think it's a valid ambiguity.
Here's law professor Timothy McClendon again.
I think there might be a minor or a slight preference for preserving the elective process where it can fit within the time period. But that, of course, is what makes the decision on this and the quick resolution of it all the more imperative.
The governor had agreed to delay his appointment decision as long as legally possible to give the court time to consider the case. Late Friday, it did. Palm Beach County voters will determine who fills Judge Johnson's old seat. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
And while we're hanging out in the judicial branch, courts throughout the country are debating the U.S. Constitution when it comes to things like blood alcohol level tests. On a state level, the Florida Supreme Court will decide if punishment for refusing a breath test violates the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Tori Whitley reports.
In the television show The West Wing, Roberto Mendoza refuses to take a breath test. Here's his reason.
Why didn't you take the breathalyzer?
Because I was driving within the speed limit. I was driving on the right side of the road. I have valid tags and registration, and as far as I know, I don't have any warrants for my arrest in Connecticut.
Now the Florida Supreme Court will decide if certain punishments for multiple refusals of a breath test is constitutional. Volusia County resident William Williams is challenging Florida's refusal to submit law, which his lawyers say violate the Fourth Amendment. It protects against unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. In October 2013, an officer arrested Williams for suspicion of driving under the influence. He refused to submit to a breath test, and the officer didn't have a warrant. According to state law, the first refusal to a breath test results in 1 year suspension of someone's driver's license. According to the refusal to submit law, if a Florida resident refuses to take a test again in a different circumstance, the driver's license is suspended for 18 months and the driver receives a first-degree misdemeanor. The Fifth District Court of Appeal ruled for the law last year. Kristen Allen is from Mothers Against Drunk Driving. She says if the Florida Supreme Court rules with Williams, it would put Florida law enforcement in a bind.
It ties the law enforcement's hands, really, because, you know, we're talking about the unreasonable searches and seizures. And if we're saying breath testing is a search or seizure, it's a reasonable search.
There's also the consideration of time. The Florida Police Chiefs Association President Brett Raley says waiting for a warrant for a blood alcohol test can compromise results.
I believe that a breath test taken as close to contemporaneous with the driving actions of a person suspected of impaired driving is best evidence, not waiting until a warrant can be obtained at a later point and then trying to extrapolate back to the time of driving.
But there are some that believe that this could escalate to further problems.
His Fourth Amendment rights are targeted by that statute.
That's Jeremy Cohen, a court lawyer with Black & Cohen who has experience in DUI cases. He says the Florida Supreme Court could find the laws narrowly tailored, meaning because it only applies to people who have a record of refusing blood tests, the law is constitutional.
The concern I have, though, is as individuals that have constitutional rights, the more that you allow those warrantless searches and seizures to chip away at our constitutional rights, the less and less rights we have. And if it's applied beyond Mr. Williams or beyond someone that previously refused, then all of us are in jeopardy and all of us have lost rights in the process. When these things kind of slide through, nobody really is paying much attention, and all of a sudden they wake up and it's like, where did my rights go?
The debate over these tests is also on a national scale. In April, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments from cases in Minnesota and South Dakota over the constitutionality of criminally penalizing someone for refusing to take an alcohol-level test. Florida is one of about a dozen states with this law. The Florida Supreme Court will hear Williams' case on September 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tori Whitley.
Oh, let's throw in a little bit of national politics while we're at it, huh? Democrat Hillary Clinton holds a slight lead over Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump in a head-to-head matchup in Florida, but voters remain deeply divided along lines of gender, race, and ethnicity. That according to a poll released today by Mason-Dixon Polling and Research. Clinton leads Trump by a margin of 45% to 42%. That's within the polls, 4 percentage point margin of error, Mason-Dixon said. Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson received 6%, while 7% of the voters were undecided. A matchup between Trump and Democrat Bernie Sanders showed them deadlocked at 42% in Florida. Like other surveys, the Mason-Dixon poll showed deep divides in Florida about the presidential race. For example, women voters support Clinton by a margin of 55 to 33% over Trump, while men support Trump by a margin of 52% to 34%. Similarly, white voters support Trump by a margin of 55% to 31%, but black voters support Clinton by a margin of 90% to 4%, and Hispanic voters support Clinton by a margin of 68% to 20%. The telephone poll of just over 600 registered Florida voters was conducted from Tuesday to Thursday of this week, and the poll said that all of the voters surveyed indicated they are likely to vote in the November election. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, researchers are looking into a new way to fight cancer, and that living tool weighs thousands of pounds, has four legs, and a trunk. They're elephants, and they rarely get cancer. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus's Elephant Retirement Facility in Central Florida teamed up with the researchers to figure out why. As we hear from Topher Forges, the hope is that research will help people.
Mysore, an Asian elephant, uses her trunk to stuff a second piece of bread into her mouth. She's standing in a sandy enclosure at the Ringling Brothers Center for Elephant Conservation in Polk City. Mysore is more than 70 years old and weighs about 7,000 pounds. Long, reddish-brown hairs cover her wrinkled head and torso. She spent 55 years in showbiz before retiring here. Now she spends her time lounging and figuring out how she can get more bread out of visitors. But Mysore's become part of a new act in her retirement. She's a cancer study subject. Researchers use blood from Asian elephants like her to solve a puzzle involving elephants, cancer, and people. That puzzle goes like this. Cancer is a leading cause of death among humans, but researchers found only about 4% of elephants die from it. Dr. Wendy Kiso is the center's director of conservation research. She says that does not make sense when you consider the size of an elephant versus a person.
Think of elephants. They're 100 times bigger than us. Thus, they have 100 times more cells than us. Thus, they have 100 times more potential for the cells to replicate and cause cancer.
But, she says, elephants rarely die of cancer. Kiso thinks the answer is a gene both humans and elephants have called P53. It's a tumor-fighting gene. Humans normally have only 2 copies, and elephants have roughly 40.
So if 1 or 2 go bad, they have that many backup. So they have evolved in such a way to have this to prevent cancer.
The project includes the Elephant Retirement Center and scientists in Salt Lake City and Israel. Ringling got involved around 2013 with Dr. Joshua Schiffman, a pediatric oncologist in Salt Lake. He was already looking into this elephant cancer question. He first heard that elephants rarely get cancer at a 2012 workshop in Maine.
It was like a light switch went off, and I began to wonder if we could focus more on who doesn't get cancer, like these elephants. Can we maybe understand how to learn from that and translate that one day to our patients?
Schiffman was getting some African elephant blood from a local zoo. Ringling researchers eventually saw a presentation on his work and gave him a call.
They explained Ringling Brothers has the largest herd of Asian elephants in the Western Hemisphere, and they were actually going to be in Salt Lake with their circus, and they wanted to know if we wanted to collaborate because they, too, draw blood on a routine basis from their elephants to make sure that they're healthy, and we were able to coordinate that blood draw.
Schiffman's research, now with a steady supply of Asian elephant blood from Ringling, involves exposing cells to radiation so they develop into tumors. In humans, P53 will first try to repair the cells, but in elephants, P53 will mostly just kill them.
It was as if the elephants had said, it's so important that we don't develop cancer, why take the risk of not fixing it all the way, the DNA damage, let's just kill the cells and start over. And we said to ourselves, my gosh, nature has done it again.
The collaborators published their findings last fall in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Schiffman says there's still a lot of testing to be done. He says they're also working with a researcher in Israel to figure out a way to deliver a potential drug to people.
We're trying to figure out how do we actually get this elephant P53 to the people who need it most so that people hopefully one day don't have to get cancer anymore, just like the elephants almost never get cancer.
Schiffman says he hopes to begin testing a new drug in humans in the next 3 to 5 years. He says they will continue receiving blood from the elephants at the Ringling Conservation Center. All of the former circus elephants, which retired this month, now live there. I'm Topher Forges in Fort Myers.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Tori Whitley and our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Florida Tax Watch Prudential Productivity Awards, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas on June 23rd in Tampa. Sponsored by Prudential, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plans. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.